Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
This recording, released March 2023, features a choir of inmates at the D.C. jail who are being held on January 6th related charges. They're singing the Star-Spangled Banner, and that's former President Donald Trump speaking over them, reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. This is the first time in American history that a president, current, future, or past, has recorded a single with a choir of alleged felons. Trump's embrace of the January 6th rioters makes a certain amount of sense. After all, they've all been charged with crimes arising out of a rally that he had called, that he had promised would be wild. And now, Trump's been charged too. In some ways, their fates are intertwined. The prisoners' biggest hope for freedom is if Trump wins the 2024 election. He has all but promised them pardons.
And if I win, we will treat those people from January 6th fairly. We will treat them fairly. And if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons because they are being treated so unfairly.
Trump's election is his own best hope, too. If he wins, he takes office and waves his hand, and good things happen. The federal cases likely go away, either because he pardons himself or because his new attorney general drops them. And the state charges probably go into hibernation while he's in office. But if he loses in November, he faces 88 felony counts in 4 different criminal trials, 2 of them at the federal level, 1 in New York State Court, and 1 in Georgia State Court.
They want to take away my freedom because I will never let them take away your freedom. It's very simple. They want to silence me because I will never let them silence you. They want you silent.
But Trump is situated very differently than the rioters. The people who stormed the Capitol committed straightforward crimes that were easier to investigate, easier to indict, easier to prove. So 3 years after January 6th, the story of how they have been held criminally accountable is mostly over. But for Trump and the other January 6th plotters, that story is just beginning. This is The Aftermath, Episode 5. With liberty and justice for some. I'm your host, Natalie Orpett. It's common to talk about the January 6th investigation, but January 6th actually gives rise to multiple criminal investigations. For many Americans, the rightful focus of the Justice Department should be on Trump and the people who surrounded him. But the department, at least initially, has other ideas. Here's Katie Benner, a reporter for the New York Times.
Investigators, especially at the FBI, wanted to focus on the rioters on the ground. They really didn't want to get into the speakers at the rally before the riot. They didn't want to get into anything that seemed like a First Amendment issue, is I think what they were saying most vocally. Behind that was always the shadow of, if you start looking at the people who were at the rally, exhorting people to act, you're really than looking at Donald Trump directly.
As Benner says, there are good reasons to focus on the rioters in the aftermath of the attack.
Obviously, because there were so many people, because the police were so outnumbered, they arrested almost nobody on the scene. They actually gave tickets to about six or seven, but for the most part, they couldn't handle it.
That's the voice of Roger Parloff, a senior editor at Lawfare, who has been closely tracking the criminal trials arising out of the January 6th attack.
But almost immediately, the arrests did start. And it was mainly the people that, it was the low-hanging fruit initially, the people that were judged most violent and most dangerous, like the QAnon shaman. Everyone saw him the first day. All the Oath Keepers were, everyone saw this remarkable phenomenon of the people marching in stack formation up the steps in military uniforms. And with the Oath Keepers, there was an added concern. And at this time, there was still a fear, which turned out to be a justified fear, that efforts would be made to disrupt the inauguration.
So in the days after the Capitol attack, there's a real sense that more trouble may be imminent. Officials are afraid of violence at Biden's inauguration. Remember, someone had actually planted two bombs, one at the Democratic National Committee and one at the Republican National Committee, on January 6th. But the police have no idea who it was. It raises the specter of more terrorist attacks. And the sheer number of perpetrators who had engaged in serious violence was daunting.
There was a press conference fairly early by the U.S. attorney at that time, and he said something about we're going after the alligators closest to the boat.
Obviously, the impetus, the marching orders by federal law enforcement was to find, fix, and charge these individuals as fast as possible. So the prosecutors from the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office, we looked for the most simple charge we could file as quick as possible.
And there's another reason to focus on the rioters. The people in charge of the Justice Department will be stepping down in a matter of days, which means it's not exactly a convenient time to kick off a complicated, politically sensitive investigation into who else might be responsible. But investigating the rioters can't wait. There's an urgent need to collect evidence before it's too late. A massive crowd had engaged in what was pretty clearly criminal conduct, much of it violent, on live TV. Thanks to video coverage and social media, some of the proof is already out there for all the world to see. But it will take a lot of work to turn that into evidence that can be used in a court of law. Here's Mary McCord, who has served in several high-level positions in the Justice Department, including 20 years in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia. That's the office running the January 6th investigations.
There's video, there's audio, there's the proof is right there. There are admissions in many cases from many of the rioters bragging about what they did, right, on that day and in the immediate aftermath. So it's those are just much easier cases to bring. As a former prosecutor, rarely do you get cases where the evidence is so unbelievably strong and irrefutable. When I was still a line attorney going to court prosecuting cases, to even think about having something like a video of the crime being committed where you see my defendant, wow, that's like, those cases usually end in what, in a plea agreement.
This is the textbook way to kick off a complex investigation. Go from the ground up. Start with the crimes that are easiest to prove and work up the chain of a possible conspiracy. Get the little fish to cooperate in order to build the strongest possible case against the big fish. It's something the FBI and Justice Department lawyers know how to do. Well, so they get to work.
Numbers may continue to rise. Officials say at least 50 police officers were hurt. Tonight, D.C. police say their investigation is ramping up.
We still have a significant amount of work ahead of us to identify and hold each and every one of the violent mob accountable for their actions. We have collected numerous images of persons of interest that we are asking the community to help us identify.
But still, there's no movement on Trump. On March 11, 2021, a new attorney general is finally confirmed, Merrick Garland. Will he do anything about Trump? Here's Katie Benner.
In March of 2021, there was still a fantasy, I think, that Trump was going to go away, that he was not going to be politically powerful, that Republicans would not want him to be the standard bearer, and that the department would be able to go about the business of upholding the rule of law and not be embroiled in politics. It was a fantasy, but it was one that was engaged in, I think, in good faith. I don't think that Garland was doing it because he didn't want to take seriously Trumpism and the impact of Trump on the department. I think he was doing it because he really just wanted to believe that the department and its ideals were that powerful.
And that philosophy extends to how he approaches the department itself.
When Merrick Garland became the attorney general, he was asked early in his tenure whether or not he was going to do any kind of like inquiry or fact-finding mission to understand how Trump had impacted the department. And he said no. He said, I believe that the men and women of the department are going to do their jobs. They're going to uphold the highest ideals of the Justice Department. And they're going to uphold the rule of law. And that's what we do.
In fact, Garland has been clear about this philosophy since before he actually took office. Here he is at his confirmation hearing on January 7th, 2021.
This time, the January 6th assault on our nation's capital. We have now, as we have then, an enormous task ahead to move forward as a country, to punish the perpetrators, to do everything possible to prevent similar attacks, and to do so in a manner that affirms the values on which our justice system is founded and upon which our democracy depends. The resolve and dedication with which the Justice Department has approached the investigation of the January 6th attack reflects the seriousness with which we take this assault on a mainstay of our democratic system, the peaceful transfer of power.
The result is a bifurcation of the Justice Department's response to January 6th.
The way we know that this played out, we had all of these people, which I called the blue-collar defendants, who were the people that were on the ground. They, by and large, it was people who went inside the building, or it was people who engaged in violence, even outside the building. So a lot of those people were charged, even though they didn't make it into the Capitol.
So on the one hand, there are the rioters themselves, the people Roger refers to as the blue-collar defendants. But there's another group, too. He calls them the white-collar perpetrators.
There were a lot of people that we all knew were responsible for setting this thing up, but they did not go in. People like Flynn didn't go in, Michael Flynn, for all his fiery rhetoric. Ali Alexander, Alex Jones, Steve Bannon got nowhere near the place. But anyway, for the most part, some very important players never got near the building, even though they played a huge part in disseminating the key lethal election lies. And of course, at the top of the pyramid was Trump at the Ellipse. He wanted to go, but they wouldn't let him. And so the question was, would any of the white-collar people ever be charged?
So, is the criminal justice system treating the blue-collar perpetrators differently than the white-collar ones? In a word, yes. One of the reasons they're treated differently is that Trump's prosecution and those of the January 6th rioters don't actually come out of the same investigation. In fact, it's never been entirely clear how closely connected their conduct really was. As Mary McCord explains,
I think there was some reason to believe here that at least some of those involved in the writing might have had connections to people in Trump's orbit. But I don't think it would have been sufficient to say that's our entire strategy, because certainly many of those people involved in the rioting were just people who drove in from wherever or flew in from wherever just because the former president said, be there, be wild. And they believed his claims that the election had been stolen, and they wanted to protest that and then got swept up in a violent attack. Others, as we know, based on the convictions, seditious conspiracy and others, had really planned for there to be violence and led that violence. And there was some reason to believe that maybe some people might have had connections, not necessarily with Trump himself, but maybe people like Mike Flynn and Roger Stone, people who the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys had been seen associating with and even, quote unquote, protecting.
It's not really clear how long prosecutors pursue the possibility that there are connections between blue collar and white collar. And it's not clear whether they pursue that strategy to the exclusion of investigating the white collar folks in parallel. Either way, the criminal justice system's response to January 6th ends up dividing suspects into two separate categories and pursuing them on separate tracks. And one thing is clear. Accountability looks very different for each of them. So how does it all play out? Let's start, as the Justice Department did, with the rioters themselves, the blue-collar folks. Investigations begin in earnest within days of January 6th. The U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. takes charge. Here's Roger Parloff.
For instance, on January 13th, they sought a warrant from a magistrate to Google for location history information. And basically they said, initially give us anonymized information for how many phones were inside the perimeter of the Capitol, as far as you can tell, on January 6th between 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. And then there were about 5,700 of those. And then they said, how many of those were totally within the Capitol based on the margin of error? And that was about 1,500. And then they narrowed it down a little more with some control groups and then sought personalized information for those people.
There's another key source of information for identifying these suspects, their own social media accounts.
Almost 80% of those arrested had boasted about being there or had talked about going there to stop the certification. There was a tremendous amount of chest beating.
It's an awful lot of investigative material to handle. Fortunately, law enforcement ends up getting crucial support from the so-called sedition hunters, a group of civilians who mine social media and open source material for hints about who had attacked the Capitol.
They apparently had or devised software fairly early on that could search video in a way that the FBI couldn't initially. And so they began to feed tips to the FBI. And I think it took a while for the FBI to get comfortable that these were not crackpots. The FBI had to be careful, but eventually that became a hugely important source of identifications of serious perpetrators.
Law enforcement also gets some help from the press, which is doing its own mining of open source materials. Here's the beginning of a Wall Street Journal video investigation published on January 20th, 2021.
One of the most prominent groups to storm the Capitol on January 6th was the Proud Boys. The Wall Street Journal analyzed hundreds of videos from the riot, social media posts, court filings, and interviewed participants in the events and experts on extremism in an effort to piece together the most complete picture of the Proud Boys' role in the events that day.
Criminal investigations would later confirm the Wall Street Journal's thesis. The Proud Boys had played a significant role in bringing about the January 6th insurrection. So who are the Proud Boys?
The Proud Boys start in 2016. And so the group usually defines itself, they have as a pro-Western fraternal organization for men who refuse to apologize for creating the modern world. So they call themselves Western chauvinists in that sense. They had close to 120 chapters around the U.S. They deny being white supremacist. There was a drinking club aspect to it, but there was also a political aspect to it. And some were more in one category called the Party Boys, and some were more in the political category called the Rally Boys. And they had a taste for violence.
The most prominent Proud Boy is the group's leader, Enrique Tarrio.
Yeah, Enrique Tarrio was, Afro-Cuban, very charismatic. He was a friend of Roger Stone's. He had political ambitions. He was a candidate for a while in a Republican primary in Florida in 2020, I think. He was about 36 at the time of January 6th. And he seemed to unite the rally boys and the party boys.
But Tarrio isn't at the Capitol on January 6th. He had been arrested on January 4th for destroying a Black Lives Matter sign during a pro-Trump demonstration at which four people were stabbed. He was in possession of two high-capacity magazines at the time of his arrest, so faced additional gun charges as well. As a result, he was barred from entering the district on January 6th. So on the ground, another Proud Boy, Ethan Nordine, takes up the leadership mantle.
Ethan Nordine was from Auburn, Washington. His claim to fame was at one of these brawls, he punched an Antifa guy or whatever, and it became a meme online. He really seems to put him in the hospital with one punch. It's called The Punch. So he becomes what's called Sergeant of Arms at the Seattle chapter. And he, when Tarrio is arrested, he becomes the leader on the ground. He also does some podcasts that are fairly alarming.
What does Nordine have to say on those podcasts? Here's one example from December 28th, 2020.
Well, the only thing left is force. I don't want to have to use force against the government. I don't want to do that. Like, I don't think anybody really wants to, because the repercussions are just unknown. Yeah. And you put yourself on the biggest fucking target list known to man. Nobody wants to do that.
We're not anti-government.
But here's the thing, is we'll replace you. We don't care about we care about law and order that much. Well, we will assemble an army that will literally just replace you like that. Like, yeah. We'll just be like, here, I'll take your badge. It's mine now.
And a few days later.
Discourse? What are we supposed to debate? No, you have to use force. This is the organized militia, part of our freaking constitution. This is something that we need to get back and ingrained in our heads and desensitize ourselves from this stuff that we've been taught. You never use violence. Well, I'm sorry. That's literally the foundation of every prominent country is force. When police officers go after criminals, they use force, which is AKA violence, okay?
So on January 6th, Nordine leads the charge, accompanied by fellow Proud Boy Joe Biggs. But unlike many other rioters, they don't start at the Ellipse. They don't hear Trump, Giuliani, Eastman, and others give their Stop the Steal speeches. They don't need to. They have a plan.
Hey, let me get a little closer to Joe. Hey, right in there.
1776. They begin at 10 a.m. at the Washington Monument.
So he and Nordine have bullhorns, and they are saying things like, we represent the spirit of 1776. Real men are here. This is Nordine. We know what the oath is. Support and defend the Constitution of the United States against foreign enemies and domestic. Let us remind those who have forgotten what that means.
At 10:15, Nordine, Biggs, and the rest of the Proud Boys head toward the Capitol. They walk a mile and a half to the Peace Circle, which at this point is only guarded by one officer. Nordine delivers a speech and reminds the group why they are there.
We got Joe Biggs here, we got Rufio.
If you haven't noticed, real men are here. We know what the oath is.
They keep moving. They talk to the police. On the east side of the Capitol, they even stop to pray.
And then at 11:47, there's an exchange where we know this because one of the Proud Boys is a guy, Eddie Block. He's a guy in a wheelchair, and he's filming the whole thing. So we hear somebody say,
right there,
take the fucking Capitol.
Come on, tighten up.
And another voice says,
let's not fucking yell that, all right?
Don't yell it, do it.
They arrive at the peace circle near the Capitol at 12:49, just 10 minutes before the joint session of Congress certifying the electoral votes is set to begin. Everything up to this point is, for the most part, peaceful. But tensions start rising.
Fuck Antifa!
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 One member of the group approaches a barrier, then topples it. All eyes are now on the group's ground leader, Ethan Nordine.
Nordine puts his fist up in the air. And that means, as his lawyer will say hundreds of times during the trial, stop. It doesn't mean go forward, it means stop. But then, as his lawyer won't say hundreds of times, the fist comes down, forward, and it means we go forward. And he goes in, and he has led 200 Proud Boys to that spot. They had 200 to 300 Proud Boys at the Washington Monument. And they go in, and they begin running up that walkway. Some of the Proud Boys are clearing some bike rack barriers out of the way.
After clearing the bike racks, the crowd of Proud Boys reaches another metal fence, which they dismantle and use as weapons against the police. After almost an hour, they overpower the police officers stationed at the Northwest Capitol staircase. They eventually reach the window at the Senate wing doors and smash it open with a riot shield. And hordes of people begin pouring into the Capitol building. More Proud Boys, and also other rioters with no known affiliations to extremist groups. But the Proud Boys are leading the way.
So they are playing a very significant role, much more important than the Oath Keepers in terms of actually, you know, they're right there at the tip of the spear, leading the penetration, leading the riot.
The world is watching in horror as images of the Capitol attack reach the airwaves. But in Baltimore, Enrique Tarrio is watching all of this go down, and he is celebrating.
He's writing on Parler, enjoying the show, do what must be done, don't fucking leave, proud of my boys and my country, 1776. This is no longer Washington, D.C. This is the city of the people of the United States. Come and take it. But most of all, at 2:40 p.m., he writes to his own Proud Boy elders on Telegram, encrypted Telegram, and he says, make no mistake, we did this.
You know what happens next. The riot continues for several harrowing hours. Dozens, if not hundreds, of people are injured, and four members of the crowd die. Ultimately, Congress reconvenes and certifies Biden's election. What's important for this story is what happens a month later. Ethan Nordine is arrested on February 3, 2021, and later indicted on 6 charges, including conspiracy and obstructing an official proceeding. But Enrique Tarrio isn't indicted until March 7, 2022. His indictment isn't all that different from the charges being brought against scores of other rioters. So it takes almost a month for the Proud Boy at the tip of the spear to be indicted, even though his face had appeared in countless images of the violence at the Capitol. And over a year passes before the indictment of the group's leader. But even by then, there is no perceptible movement on prosecuting the white-collar perpetrators. As Roger Parloff explains, we know now that there were proponents of investigating these people almost immediately after January 6th.
There was an early attempt, I think as early as February, there was a prosecutor, there were several prosecutors at the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C., who wanted to probe Roger Stone, Alex Jones, and Ali Alexander. At that time, in February 2021, the FBI and the higher-ups in the U.S. Attorney's Office and DOJ felt that this was premature. It was going to look like they were politicizing. They didn't have the predication that you would want to before you would investigate, you know, start looking into their phone records. Similarly, also in February, the National Archives had noticed similarities in fraudulent slates of electors from seven states, that they were nearly identical. And that looked suspicious, like somebody was, like this was an organized fraud. And the National Archives Office of Inspector General brought this to the attention of the DOJ Election Crimes Unit. But at that time, they chose not to pursue it. So there were these earlier things that were stifled.
But we won't learn about all that until much later on. At the time, during that first year after January 6th, it just looks like nothing is happening on the white-collar side. No arrests, no signs of investigations. Then, in January 2022, Merrick Garland gives a speech marking the one-year anniversary of the January 6th attack. He promises that the Justice Department is working diligently to prosecute those responsible, that it's following the evidence, and that it will not stop until everyone is held accountable.
The Justice Department remains committed to holding all January 6 perpetrators at any level accountable under law, whether they were present that day or were otherwise criminally responsible for the assault on our democracy. We will follow the facts wherever they lead.
Only 8 days after that speech, the Justice Department unseals an indictment against members of the Oath Keepers. It contains the most serious criminal charge yet, seditious conspiracy. 6 months later, in June 2022, the Justice Department brings the same charge against some of the Proud Boys, including Enrique Tarrio and Ethan Nordin.
Late yesterday, the Justice Department announced the leader of the far-right Proud Boys, Enrique Tarrio, and four associates have been charged with seditious conspiracy for their alleged role in the attack on the Capitol. This is only the second time a group tied to January 6th faces the rare and very serious charge of conspiring to block the execution of U.S. law or overthrow the U.S. government.
Seditious conspiracy is a big charge, and it's very difficult to prove sedition. Prosecutors will have to convince a jury that the defendants conspired to use force to overthrow or oppose the authority of the U.S. government. Here's former Justice Department official Mary McCord.
It's not a charge that the department brings very often. They've not had good success with it when it comes to domestic violent extremist cases. I think what's so different here, though, from in at least the most recent failures is here, you didn't have to guess, was this really just talking big and braggadocio that we're going to go and take on Congress and try to make sure that Trump stays in power? You don't have to guess it. Would they really carry it out? Because they did. And I think they're significant because for the government to shy away from bringing the charge that really does seem to apply by its terms, by its elements, the statute just is very clear. Using force to hinder or delay the execution of U.S. law, that's exactly what they did. And there was ample evidence of conspiring to do it, the planning for that for days and weeks of planning for that, coordination, logistics, all of that the government had the proof of, which they put on at trial. And so I think it was significant that they not shy away from it, that they bring that charge.
In the meantime, the criminal prosecutions of lower-level blue-collar perpetrators has continued at full tilt. So at the end of 2022, here's where things stand. On the blue-collar side, more than 950 people have been arrested, including more than 280 charged with assaulting or impeding law enforcement. More than 500 have been convicted. And prosecutors have worked their way up from the easiest cases to the more complicated ones, securing indictments on very serious criminal charges. 2 years of hard work by the government have put a lot of people in jail, and many others in jeopardy of heading there. So now it's 2023. The Proud Boys trial begins on January 13th, 2 years since the attack. the case, as it goes to trial, has five defendants.
The five that went to trial were Tario, Nordine, a guy named Zach Reel, who was a leader from Philadelphia, Pizzola, who was not really a leader. He was a soldier, but he was a favored soldier. And Joe Biggs. Joe Biggs was another leader.
Each defendant is charged with some variation of 10 separate counts. All are charged with seditious conspiracy. The trial spans 62 days. Like the hundreds of other January 6th cases tried by the Justice Department, prosecutors come equipped with tranches of evidence implicating the defendants, screenshots of Telegram conversations, videos, photographs, audio, and more. But like the Oath Keepers trial, federal prosecutors face a steeper challenge than simply proving that the Proud Boys participated in the riot. They need to prove, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the defendants hadn't just gotten caught up in the moment. Through footage and private and public communications, the government presents its case to the jury.
The theory of this case is that, no, these guys are more the pointy end of the spear. I don't think they get into the question, would there have been a riot without them? Would there have been an insurrection without them? But certainly they play a crucial role, and that's the government's case.
In addition to the other evidence of defendants' criminal conduct, prosecutors point to that message Tario sent over Telegram to Proud Boys leadership, saying, make no mistake, we did this. But prosecutors don't have anything laying out an explicit, organized plan to storm the Capitol. There's no smoking gun. So prosecutors have to distill bits and pieces of evidence to illustrate a narrative that is both easy to understand and compelling enough to convince a jury of the Proud Boys' guilt. One of the pieces of evidence prosecutors rely on is the fact that in the lead-up to January 6th, the defendants had created a new group chapter.
You do have the same sorts of inflammatory rhetoric that you had with the Oath Keepers, beginning with basically the election. But then there is a point when, after Trump issues his tweet on December 19th, it'll be wild, calling for everybody to come to a January 6th protest. The next day, Tario creates a new chapter of the Proud Boys called Ministry of Self-Defense. And he creates a Telegram channel called Ministry of Self-Defense Leaders Group. And then they begin recruiting people into a Ministry of Self-Defense members group. And it's going to be very hierarchical, which is not common for the Proud Boys. It sort of can come off like a drinking group until now.
Prosecutors also point to the group's discussions about what to wear to better blend into the crowd.
And then on December 28th, he and other defendants begin informing the others, we will not be wearing our traditional black and yellow. We will be incognito on January 6th. So that's a huge change. You know, part of being a Proud Boy is you know, wearing your colors. They wear black and yellow. They have these sort of Fred Perry laurel insignias. They've actually sort of appropriated the Fred Perry symbol. But they're not going to do that. And the reason they seem to be saying they're not going to do that is so that they can blend in with other rioters who won't realize that they are Proud Boys. And this is the part of the government's case, that they are going to incite the quote-unquote normies, the non-organized thugs, into rioting. And they turn them, in effect, into their tools. And they have bullhorns, and they lead chants, and they help incite this riot. And that's the theory. And there is evidence of all of this. And then they begin bringing Baofeng radios. They have GoFundMe drives to fund protective wear. And so there is planning, but you still don't have a smoking gun sort of document or a video conference, a taped video conference where the plans are laid out.
Prosecutors also point to the Proud Boys' behavior just days before the insurrection. Remember when Tario was arrested on January 4th for burning a Black Lives Matter flag?
When he's arrested, there's tremendous concern among all the defendants because the government now has his phone. And so they begin deleting the previous Ministry of Self-Defense Telegram groups or nuking them, as a couple of the defendants say, and creating a new Ministry of Self-Defense leaders group and a new Ministry of Self-Defense members group.
So the prosecutors pieced together strong circumstantial evidence. Despite not having a straightforward video or a document that explicitly lays out the Proud Boys' plan to take the Capitol, prosecutors assert that their behavior before and during the riot clearly points to some sort of organized plan of action for January 6th.
They had a function, and they had assignments, and that's not really in dispute. Here, it's not clear what the alibi is. Why did 300 people gather at the Washington Monument and then walk directly to the Capitol?
Lawyers for Tario, Nordine, and others, however, tell a much different story.
Basically, everyone was arguing that this was a spontaneous event, and they were just like the other 1,300 people that have been charged. There was no conspiracy. They were basically, this should be a trespass, that sort of argument.
The defendants put forward a two-pronged defense. First, they had attended the January 6th Stop the Steal rally simply to make their voices heard. And second, everything that had happened once they got there was spontaneous.
The plan is to go to the Washington Monument, and then Nordine leads this march, and it does seem sort of like nobody knows what's happening. And several people in the march said, we didn't know what was happening. And they go to the Capitol, and I'm giving the defense case now. There's a better, there's strong things the prosecution can say here. But they go to some food trucks, and they would say some people say, well, we expected to go back to the rally, the ellipse. And then others say, gee, it seemed like at the food trucks, some people were saying we should go back to our hotels. There was even one guy who said Nordine wanted to go back to his hotel, that he was hungover. But of course, they don't go back to their hotel. They go to the Peace Circle and they arrive there at exactly the perfect time.
But the prosecution pushes back and presents more and more evidence against the Proud Boys. They stress the conspiracy law doesn't require a predetermined plan. They argue that the defendants had come to the Capitol with a common understanding. The Proud Boys, prosecutors said, had wanted to do whatever was necessary, up to and including the use of force, to stop the vote count. So when the opportunity presented itself, they took it.
And there is an element of spontaneity, and there were two cooperating witnesses. They did not describe a plan. It sounds like there was an element of spontaneity. But once the barricades fell, everyone knew what to do. In fact, for me, there was an important point that the government did not mention. Maybe they didn't think it was helpful. One of the cooperating witnesses, Matt Green, said, he was fairly low-level guy. He was with Pezzola. And he wondered, during the march, he kept wondering, what is this about? What are we doing? Why are we moving away from the ellipse? And, he thought they were going to see the speech. And they went to the Capitol. And then when the barricade at the Peace Circle fell, he thought, oh, shit, this is it. And that was his testimony. Oh, shit, this is it. And in a way, that was the reality, and that was sort of the government's case. That yes, there was an element of spontaneity, but everyone had been primed and knew what to do then. And in fact, that was emphasized in the government's summation, that conspiracy there isn't a duration element. You could wait until, I think the words were, so long as the defendant joined at any time, even if not until January 6th, even if not until the barricades at the Peace Circle already came down, that's enough. So that's the case. It's not as, you know, it's not as strong as I think I thought it might have been before the case started. There is no pre-planning. So some of the most of the defendants focused on that, even though that's not technically the legal definition. You know, you don't need pre-planning. You need a common understanding.
There is one defendant, however, that seems a bit harder to nail down, especially since he wasn't even at the Capitol during the riot, Enrique Tarrio. In closing arguments, prosecutors say that Tarrio had ignited the seditious conspiracy weeks before January 6th when he formed the Proud Boys Ministry of Self-Defense. That's the group that became the fighting force responsible for the violence at the Capitol. Prosecutors say that Nordine assembled hundreds of Proud Boys, led them to the Capitol, and helped to breach the building security. Prosecutors say of Nordine and his co-defendants, they went into that building like soldiers into a conquered city. But Tarrio's lawyer emphasizes that he wasn't even in Washington on the 6th, and that it is Trump, not Tarrio, who should be held responsible for pressuring the crowd outside the Capitol to fight like hell. Nordine's lawyer, in turn, says that prosecutors spent the case manipulating the jury to hate defendants by repeatedly linking them to Trump and his alleged crimes, and trying to convince the jury that Nordine is guilty by association. The jury begins its deliberations on April 26, 2023, after nearly 4 months of trial. 1 week later, we have a verdict.
A federal jury today found four members of the Proud Boys guilty of seditious conspiracy. That includes the group's former leader, Enrique Tarrio, along with members Ethan Nordine, Joseph Biggs, and Zachary Real. A fifth member, Dominic Pozzola, was found not guilty of seditious conspiracy. But he and the others were convicted of obstruction and destruction of property.
The jury finds Nordine and Tarrio guilty on six counts, including seditious conspiracy. A few weeks later, they're both sentenced. Nordine gets 18 years. Tarrio gets 22 years, the longest sentence to date for any January 6th defendant.
So these sentences, these five people, well, at this point, there have been about 1,150 cases brought, and four of the five top sentences are Proud Boys, five of the top 10. Seven of the top 10 are Proud Boys or Oath Keepers. That said, they were years below what the government asked and years below their sentencing guidelines.
So the government has secured at least a partial victory against some of the most serious offenders. In the meantime, its successes holding other blue-collar defendants accountable has continued as well. By the end of 2023, 1,265 people have been indicted, 452 of them for assaulting, resisting, or impeding law enforcement. 57 defendants have been charged with conspiracy. In short, over 1,200 people have faced the criminal justice system because of what they did on January 6th, and hundreds of them are in jail. And on the white-collar side, no one is in jail. We know that the investigations seem to have gotten a later start than the blue-collar investigations. Why? As Mary McCord explains,
that's a harder investigation because, well, you don't have that enormous volume of readily accessible video evidence and audio evidence and people admitting what they've done in a public way, you know, and posting it on social media, etc. So that's one where you use other investigative tactics.
Those other investigative tactics are much more complicated, and there's a lot more strategy involved. The blue-collar defendants have to have known that law enforcement was after them. They had, after all, committed their crimes in broad daylight, with cameras all around. But that's not true of the white-collar perpetrators. So the investigation looks very different.
One of the things that's most significant in this white-collar phase of the investigation is not to take any step that could alert others to do things that might result in the destruction of evidence, whether that is digital evidence or, you know, emails and things like that, which maybe you could still get from the provider, but, you know, or just changing their, you know, organizing and coordinating together a story, right? So you want to be very careful that as you take those initial steps, you're doing everything you can to protect the investigation from those who might want to obstruct it. And I think given the very thing that was being investigated, the concern about obstruction would be pretty paramount. You know, you're waiting, you're trying to get what you can in terms of, you know, business records, phone records, that kind of thing before you go start being overt about talking maybe to people in the inner circle.
So maybe the white collar investigation too begins soon after January 6th. And we just don't realize it because the Justice Department is working very hard to keep it out of the public eye. Or maybe it takes months for the department to begin it in earnest. We don't know. Either way, by the end of 2021, it looks like essentially nothing has happened. Then, in 2022, there are finally signs of movement. The year opens with a referral from Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel.
Under state law, I think clearly you have forgery of a public record, which is a 14-year offense, and election law forgery, which is a 5-year offense. But what we have decided to do with the investigation, in light of the fact that, of course, we have seen, as you've pointed out multiple times now, various different false slate of electors from 7 different states in what seems to be a coordinated effort between the Republican parties in various different states. We think this is a matter that is best investigated and potentially prosecuted by the feds. And as such, just today, we referred this matter to the Western District, the U.S. Attorney's Office, for them to evaluate it. And we hope that Maine Justice and the Department of Justice will become involved and use the information they already have to better understand exactly what happened that day so that federal charges can be evaluated.
New Mexico and Wisconsin follow suit. Soon after, Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco gives an interview, confirming that the Justice Department is looking into it. Here she is, talking to CNN's Evan Perez.
Well, first on the issue you raised in terms of fraudulent elector certifications, as has been reported, we've received those referrals. Our prosecutors are looking at those, and I can't say anything more on ongoing investigations. But more broadly, look, the Attorney General has been very, very clear. We are going to follow the facts and the law wherever they lead to address conduct of any kind and at any level that is part of an assault on our democracy.
You remember the fake electors scheme. The people involved with that weren't in trouble for attacking the Capitol. They were suspected of other, more white-collar type crimes. Though it may have seemed so from the outside, we don't know that Secretary Nessel's announcement is responsible for kickstarting the white-collar investigation. We only know that the fake electors investigation is the first one decisively making it into the public eye. Does that mean it's the only thread the Justice Department is pursuing? Probably not. But either way, starting with the fake electors is consistent with any other white-collar investigative strategy.
So you still might have a little bit of a ground-up type of way that you do that white-collar investigation. It's just the ground-up is not the rioters. It's, you know, other people associated with the campaign who, you know, may have had involvement. And it's talking also to people, you know, who got pressured, like Brad Raffensperger, like, you know, folks in Maricopa County, Arizona, you know, talking to those people and sort of working that aspect of things.
By early spring, there are indications that other white-collar investigations are underway, too. In April, the New York Times reports that a D.C. grand jury had issued subpoenas. They're looking for records on people who organized or spoke at pro-Trump rallies after the 2020 election, including members of the executive or legislative branches. In June, the FBI executes search warrants against two figures in Trump's inner circle, John Eastman, the architect of the fake electors scheme, and Jeffrey Clark, the lawyer who tried to deploy the Justice Department in service of the big lie. Still, there's nothing to suggest that criminal charges are imminent, and it remains completely unclear whether the Justice Department is looking into Trump himself, or even planning to. Here's Katie Benner.
So for people who believe that Donald Trump tried to overthrow a free and fair election, that he's using the language of a totalitarian leader, that he's threatening his opponents, that he's trying to undermine the legal system, that he's trying to undermine our faith in the legal system, that he wants to get rid of the civil service, that he wants to basically get rid of the rule of law, and they see this as a problem. Yes, they see the Justice Department as the institution that can hold him accountable, which for, you know, whether it's Merrick Garland or Lisa Monaco, that's a nightmare, because they don't want to be in the business of holding accountable a politician who should be held accountable through the political process.
Then two things happen. The first is the January 6th committee hearings in summer 2022. As the committee makes clear from the outset, its thesis is that the rioters are not the only ones who have committed crimes, that there was a conspiracy that began long before January 6th and involved conduct far beyond merely interrupting the joint session of Congress. This seems to jolt the Justice Department into more overt action on the white-collar side. Here's Susan Glasser of The New Yorker.
I think that the Justice Department's delay in the investigation was a big political mistake. And we will probably learn more for the historical record. Ultimately, the Washington Post has already done some reporting that suggests that it really was the January 6th committee hearings that proved to be the spur that forced them to look at more directly at the issue of Trump himself and those surrounding him and what culpability they bore for the events after the 2020 election, and that up until that point, there wasn't much of a focus on Trump.
Then, on November 15th, 2022, Donald Trump makes an announcement.
In order to make America great and glorious again, I am tonight announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
Trump's announcement complicates Garland's task even further. There are a raft of Justice Department policies aiming to prevent prosecutions designed to affect the outcome of elections. And now the possible target is officially a candidate for president. Not only that, he's a candidate presumably running against Garland's own boss, Joe Biden. So Garland makes a decision. He gathers the press corps 3 days after Trump declares his candidacy.
Today, I signed an order appointing Jack Smith to serve as special counsel. The order authorizes him to continue the ongoing investigation.
It's a major development. Appointing a special counsel confirms the existence of a criminal investigation of Trump for his role in January 6th. It also signifies a dramatic departure for Garland.
Merrick Garland never wanted to appoint a special counsel. He didn't want to appoint a special counsel for any matter because the special counsel regulations say you want to appoint a special counsel in a moment where there could be reasonable questions about whether or not the Justice Department is acting fairly, whether or not the Justice Department can act impartially, where really you want the public faith to be shored up by taking an investigation out of the hands of the Attorney General and the U.S. attorneys and putting it into a quasi-independent place. He believes that in order to shore up faith in the Justice Department, that the prosecutors at the department, the FBI, need to be able to do their jobs and show the American people that they have what it takes to get it done. And that's how you restore faith in the department. Appointing a special counsel, I think to him, felt like giving up before you've even begun.
The special counsel Garland selects, Jack Smith, is a longtime prosecutor. He's well-respected within the Justice Department and broader legal community. He has sterling credentials, including a stint at the Public Integrity Unit of Maine Justice and as a director of investigations for the International Criminal Court in The Hague.
And I think it's really interesting and cannot be overstated that the special counsel and Merrick Garland are two very different people with two very different views of risk and that the special counsel is working with tremendous independence and does not have to sit in meetings with Merrick Garland, where he feels like it would be weird to bring up the word Donald Trump. So Jack Smith is approaching this investigation in a much more aggressive manner and in a different manner. His view is, what does this look like at trial? Do I have enough to go to trial? Do I have a reasonable shot of getting a conviction? And if so, I got to do it. That is a very different attitude from the one that investigators experienced in their meetings with Garland and Monaco. Now, if Garland and Monaco were here, they'd probably say that's preposterous. They would say, we, like Jack Smith, believe in being as aggressive as the facts and the law will take us. And anybody could have said anything. It's just not the way people felt around them.
Either way, the investigation of Donald Trump is now in the hands of Jack Smith. As special counsel, he operates independently from the rest of the department. He has his own staff, drawn largely from prosecutors who had already been working on January 6th investigations. He has his own methods. And he has his own clock. As McCord explains, that's a big deal.
I also think that there are some benefits to doing that, because then your leader on the investigation has nothing else that they have to do. Whereas if you've got a U.S. attorney leading an investigation, that U.S. attorney still has all the rest of the business of the U.S. attorney's office that they would otherwise have that they've got to deal with. When you suddenly appoint a special counsel, they get their own office space. They get a whole bunch of attorneys working on and investigators working on nothing but that. You can move, you know, in some cases more expeditiously. So it's clear that investigation, I mean, they did bring in some new people, but they also just sort of assigned a bunch of the people who were already working on it to the special counsel's office. They continued to work on it, but even those people now did not have other things on their plate that they might have on their plate. So I think it's a combination of the AG had to do it sort of just politically, and it did allow people to, I think, direct and designate full-time, more people, more time to these two investigations. And, you know, that's a good thing for getting to the point of indictment.
So at the end of 2022, here's where things stand on the white-collar side. There's finally some movement, but it's hard to connect the dots. Investigators seem interested in fake electors and rally organizers, but also in Jeffrey Clark, the guy who planned the coup inside the Justice Department. And now, they even seem to be looking at Donald Trump. But where is it all going? As 2023 kicks off, Trump's re-election campaign is heating up.
To change the whole system, you need a president who can take on the whole system and a president that can win. And we did great. Last time, we got 12 million more votes than we did the time before. Somebody interviewed me recently. What was the difference between 2020 and 2016? I said, the difference is we did much better in 2020. We did. Got many millions of more votes. But we got to be careful on election day.
But looming over him is the Justice Department's investigation.
At every level, state, local, elector, and then ultimately marching and storming the Capitol, might be no person larger than Giuliani. So the headline here is a big deal. That's a sign, again, that this probe, which at times had stalled out with regard to aspects of January 6th, is intensifying under Special Counsel Smith's leadership.
In July, Trump reveals that he had been informed that he could face imminent criminal charges. Then, on August 1st, 2023, an announcement.
The unprecedented third indictment of former President Donald Trump in a federal case that could test American democracy itself. A federal grand jury formally accused Donald Trump yesterday of conspiring to overturn the 2020 election.
Now, the four felony charges are conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, obstruction of and attempt to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy against rights. The indictment follows a sweeping investigation into the deadly January 6th riots and Trump's efforts to remain in power.
The thing is, the indictment itself isn't really groundbreaking. Here's Katie Benner.
We see an indictment that says, yes, many of the things we already knew, except they've been fashioned in such a way that they are now all pointing to a set of criminal statutes, which is, I find fascinating. Again, Because if that's the case, 80% of this, 75% of this could have been brought a year before it was actually brought. The indictment itself doesn't include charges that are particularly new either. So again, you say to yourself, why couldn't this have been charged a year before under Merrick Garland? He's charging people with conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding. These are things that the rioters have been charged with, and obstruction of an attempt to obstruct an official proceeding. The only new charge really is the conspiracy to basically defraud people of their rights, their voting rights, you know, saying that their votes don't count, their votes don't matter. But again, a lot of the evidence to support that charge was also either in the public record through reporting or through the J6 committee.
To be fair, we don't know what was going on behind the scenes inside the department before the indictment came out, or for how long it had been going on.
There are certainly people criticizing the department for going too slow, criticizing the attorney general for not having appointed a special counsel earlier, or maybe not having devoted adequate resources to that sort of white-collar side of the investigation. I mean, I certainly wish things had gone faster, but I'm not in a position really to criticize without knowing what may have been going on that we don't know about. And I've spent long enough, you know, 23 years in the department, both at the U.S. Attorney's Office and at Maine Justice, to know very well, it's not like they tell us everything that they are doing. You know, I'm just reluctant to cast stones about that.
But still, why does it take 2.5 years to accuse Donald Trump of crimes that many people felt had been obvious from the beginning? 2.5 years during which more than 1,000 other people have been investigated and indicted, and many of them tried and convicted, in which some people have even finished serving their sentences. Why are we only getting to Trump now? As Katie Benner sees it,
it is impossible not to infer that the reason why this indictment came together is because Jack Smith came into this with a different point of view and a different risk tolerance, and he was able to share that with his team and give them the top cover necessary to make this very high risk, very politically fraught move that other officials had not been willing to do.
There's something else notable about this indictment. It only brings charges against Trump. What about that ground-up strategy? Surely the Justice Department's investigation didn't skip from fraudulent electors straight to the former president of the United States. What about those other investigations we heard rumors about in the spring of 2022? What about those search warrants executed on John Eastman and Jeffrey Clark in June of that year? Well, if you look closely, they're in there. 3 of the 4 criminal charges listed in the indictment are conspiracy charges. And in describing Trump's alleged criminal conduct, the indictment also describes the conduct of 6 alleged co-conspirators.
The identities of these 6 Trump co-conspirators.
We are prepared to identify 5 of them at this point based on reporting. Most notably, the first unindicted co-conspirator we have identified as Rudy Giuliani. Number 2 in this indictment is former Trump attorney John Eastman. This is a person who wrote this 2-page memo. This was the plan for Mike Pence to be able to essentially overturn the 2020 presidential election while presiding over the Electoral College certification. Former Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark. And again, number 5, we have another pro-Trump lawyer. This is Kenneth Chesbro. He was someone who was very involved in this fake electors plot. The indictment points to an email memorandum that he sent to Giuliani.
So it's not that the Justice Department investigators skipped over these other white-collar folks. It's just that they didn't indict them. At least not yet. There are good reasons not to charge these alleged co-conspirators alongside Trump. As McCord explains,
obviously, if you had brought a 7 co-defendant indictment, it would have been a more complicated case to try to get to trial. You would have had 7 different represented defendants, each with their attorneys, each filing reams of motions. You'd have had to have discovery provided to all of them, discovery disputes potentially. And so the possibility of getting to trial on a relatively aggressive time frame would have really decreased by bringing a 7 co-defendant indictment.
And there's another reason. listing the alleged co-conspirators, especially at this level of detail, has a way of focusing the mind.
There's also the fact that those people can be indicted later, and that some of those people, because they see that they are listed as unindicted co-conspirators, might think about being cooperative. So I think there is a strategy piece as well as a timing piece.
So the choice not to indict people like Giuliani, Eastman, and Clark may actually be in service of building a stronger case against Trump. We won't know until much later whether any of these people will at some point cooperate with the special counsel, but it's a possibility. As it turns out, the white-collar perpetrators don't get off scot-free after all. Only 2 weeks after Jack Smith unseals his indictment in D.C., another announcement out of Fulton County, Georgia.
Based on information developed by that investigation, a Fulton County grand jury returned a true bill of indictment, charging 19 individuals with violations of Georgia law arising from a criminal conspiracy to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in this state. Please remember that everyone charged in this bill of indictment is presumed innocent.
This indictment comes out of state court. It tells a wide-ranging story encompassing the pressure campaign on state officials, various false statements about election fraud, and even the fake elector scheme. Among Trump's 18 alleged co-conspirators are several white-collar folks whose names you'll recognize, including three who pleaded guilty within months of being indicted: Kenneth Chesbrough, Sidney Powell, and Jenna Ellis. But a trial date for the others, including Trump, has not been set. And it's clear it won't happen anytime soon. Georgia isn't the only jurisdiction bringing criminal charges against the white-collar perpetrators. Alleged fake electors have also faced charges in Michigan and Nevada. So at least we know that state authorities have been investigating the broader landscape, and that at least some of the other white-collar folks are finally facing criminal accountability there. But almost 3.5 years later, it's still not clear whether any of them will ever face federal charges. All of which raises the question, is the criminal process doing its job? The story of federal criminal accountability for January 6th is a messy one. Actually, it's more like several stories. For Trump, it's still a work in progress. For the other white-collar defendants, including Giuliani, Eastman, and Clark, criminal accountability is still proving elusive. For the blue-collar defendants, it's a story of tremendous success by the Justice Department. Hundreds of people have been held criminally accountable, and the story is nearing its end. The rate of blue-collar prosecutions has slowed dramatically, as you'd expect 3 years after the event. But there's a dark cloud on the horizon. One of the felony counts that many of the blue-collar defendants were convicted of is now being challenged before the Supreme Court. The challengers argue that the statute can't be used the way prosecutors used it. If the court agrees, some or all of those convictions could be wiped out. And because Trump is charged under that same statute, the Supreme Court's ruling could gut some of the charges in his indictment as well. Oral arguments in that case, called Fisher v. United States, took place on April 16, 2024. Here's Susan Glasser of The New Yorker.
So there has been a lot of accountability for people who broke glass and smashed weapons into the faces of Capitol Police officers. And it's been an extraordinary mobilization on the part of the Justice Department to treat this fundamentally as a riot, as a law and order disruption. But the offense to the democracy itself, it seems, we've done a much poorer job of.
With respect to that, Glasser argues,
it's really hard to conclude that there's been any accountability whatsoever, given that we're in a situation where 3 years later, the vast majority of Republicans in this country say that Joe Biden was not the legitimately elected president of the United States. And it was 2/3 of the House Republican Conference that voted not to certify Biden's election, even stepping over the broken glass of the U.S. Capitol on the overnight of January 6, 2021.
It's possible that criminal accountability for Trump is just a few months down the road. It's possible that criminal accountability for the other white-collar defendants will either follow that or will take place at the state level. Even if accountability is coming, though, it certainly hasn't been as swift as it was for the rioters. Besides, it's also possible that the moment for accountability for Trump and his colleagues has passed, because the man at the center of the offense to democracy of which Glasser speaks is, once again, his party's nominee for president. Here's Katie Benner.
And I think it really speaks to people's faith in the voters that so many people who are opposed to Trump feel that only the Justice Department can stop him. And I think that's being borne out again by the fact that he's the presumptive GOP nominee for the presidency, that he has a good chance of winning, that he's gaining support amongst groups of people who one would not think logically that he would gain support among, including minorities, including women, and that people see him as a plausible and preferred candidate.
Indeed, if Trump were to win, the case against him would go away, and so would the cases against the other defendants. On July 12, 2022, at the January 6th Committee's 7th public hearing, the members heard testimony from Stephen Ayers, a man who stormed the Capitol, and Jason Van Tatenhove, the former spokesperson for the Oath Keepers. In his testimony, Van Tatenhove, who had insider knowledge of how the right-wing group and others like it organized and thought, offered a grim warning for the future.
I think we've gotten exceedingly lucky that more bloodshed did not happen because the potential has been there from the start. And we got very lucky that the loss of life was, and as tragic as it is, that we saw on January 6th, the potential was so much more. Again, all we have to look at is the iconic images of that day with the gallows set up for Mike Pence, for the Vice President of the United States. You know, and I do fear for this next election cycle, because who knows what that might bring if a president that's willing to try to instill and encourage to whip up a civil war amongst his followers using lies and deceit and snake oil, and regardless of the human impact. What else is he going to do if he gets elected again? All bets are off at that point. And that's a scary notion. I have 3 daughters. I have a granddaughter. And I fear for the world that they will inherit if we do not start holding these people to account.
The Aftermath is a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. I'm your host, Natalie Orpett. Series executive producers are Benjamin Wittes and me. Production and story editing at Goat Rodeo from Max Johnston. Senior producers are Catherine Pompilio of Lawfare and Megan Nadolski and Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo. Scripting by me, Catherine Pompilio, and Benjamin Wittes. Additional production assistance from Isabel Kirby McGowan, Jay Venables, Kara Schillen, Anna Hickey, and Maya Nicholson. Cover art by Ian Enright. To learn more about Lawfare or to support our work, visit our website at lawfaremedia.org.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.